From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudet. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, but it's also almost 2024, which means it's time for our Reporter Roundtable Year in Review. This is when we go back and talk about all of the news headlines from this last year. Today, we're lucky enough to have a really great panel of folks. Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News. Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with Idaho Statesman. Clark Corbin with Idaho Capital Sun. And our very own James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News. Hi, everybody.
Hey, Gemma.
Hello.
So let's start with one of the stories that not only made big headlines here in Idaho, but really made headlines nationally and internationally. Scott, this is Lori Vallow-Daybell. She was convicted of killing two of her children. This happened in May with the conviction after a really long trial. She was then sentenced to life without parole. Now, this trial was a culmination of a story that started more than 3 years ago. But Scott, we still have Chad Daybell's trial at some point. So update us on, you know, all of this, because as I said, this was a major, major international news story.
Right. Yeah. This all happened within the past year. It seems hard to believe. But Lori Vallow-Daybell was tried in Ada County earlier this year in the spring for killing her children, JJ 7 and Tylee 16 years old, in 2019, and accused of conspiring to kill Tammy Daybell, Chad Daybell's ex-wife. She was found guilty in May, and then she was sentenced to three consecutive life terms in prison without the possibility of parole. She was sentenced in September, and the sentencing was really unique, unusual, shocking. Lori Vallow-Daybell spoke in her own defense, and she said some things, and I think a lot of people were waiting to hear her talk and hear what she would say. Would she be contrite? Would she be remorseful? And as we know, she was accused of killing her children over religious zealotry and religious ideas. And when she spoke in her defense at her sentencing, she continued to have those views. She said that, quote, Jesus Christ knows the truth of what happened here. Jesus Christ knows that no one was murdered in this case. Accidental deaths happen. Suicides happen. Fatal side effects from medications happen. She said that she spoke with JJ and Tylee and Tammy Daybell from heaven. She said she spoke with Jesus Christ himself and called Tammy Daybell her wonderful friend. And that led Judge Stephen Boyce to impose that penalty, the three consecutive life terms without the possibility of parole. And remember that the death penalty was off the table in this case. So really, three consecutive life terms without parole was the maximum that he could impose. And he cited the fact that she was not remorseful and that she continued to hold these religious delusions. And that was one of the reasons that he imposed that sentence. And like you said, we are coming up again in the coming year, April 1st. Chad Daybell is scheduled to go on trial again in Boise. Chad Daybell and his attorneys tried to get the trial moved back to Rexburg, the Rexburg area. Mm-hmm. And the judge said, no, it's too risky to try to find an impartial jury. We're gonna try in Ada County. It worked before with Lori Vallow-Daybell. And so we're going to try the case in Ada County again. And so we'll go through all this again, scheduled for April 1st.
All right. Okay. So another kind of surprise, and I think this took a lot of folks by surprise, Kevin and Melissa, this was the University of Idaho announcing it was going to buy the University of Phoenix. So Kevin, why don't I start with you and, you know, really start where this saga began.
Well, the public part of it started in May, on May 17th, when the state board said that it was going to meet to discuss a proposal from the University of Idaho to purchase the University of Phoenix. And I think it caught everybody off guard. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is such a closely guarded process. The board had held a series of closed-door meetings to discuss it. A very small number of people were involved in the discussions, and all of those discussions took place under the you know, under the shield of a non-disclosure agreement that Phoenix insisted upon. So this really caught people by surprise. And we're talking about a $685 million transaction. It is, I've got to think, the largest transaction in the history of Idaho higher education. And arguably, it's the most polarizing transaction in the history of Idaho higher education. You have U of I and the State Board insisting that this is going to be a good deal for the state of Idaho. It's going to be a moneymaker for the University of Idaho. It's going to provide new opportunities for students, especially in rural Idaho, to tap into Phoenix's online education infrastructure. You have critics who are as adamantly opposed to this, saying Phoenix has this horrible track record, the critics say, and they have been fined $191 million a few years ago by the Federal Trade Commission. They have there's a lot of baggage to the University of Phoenix when it comes to recruiting practices, especially when it comes to recruiting veterans to attend. Yeah, there are a lot of questions about the academic performance of Phoenix. The graduation rates are not very good. So you have a very polarizing issue. And I'm very curious to see what happens in the weeks to come. You have Raul Labrador, Attorney General Labrador's lawsuit against the state board, saying that the board should not have discussed this in closed executive sessions. That lawsuit could potentially overturn the entire purchase or put the entire purchase on hold and in limbo. I'll be really curious to see what the legislature does about this, because technically the legislature doesn't have a clear place to weigh in. They don't have to approve this deal. But I think there's a good deal of skepticism within the legislature. So next month is going to be a really interesting month to see how this transaction unfolds.
Mm-hmm. And I want to go into property taxes real quick as well, because this is something that the legislature, after many years, finally passed some relief. Now, a lot of it, though, actually showed up on folks' tax bills this winter. So, Clark, can you quickly give us the background on what they passed?
Yeah, for sure, Jim. And this is, you're right, this has been an issue that Idahoans have been talking about and complaining about for years. The cost of their property taxes and the overall cost of housing and living overall. But this last legislative session, the Idaho legislature passed House Bill 292, and it provides more than $300 million altogether to reduce property taxes. There's kind of three different areas that it's focused in. One chunk of the money goes to school districts for their facilities. The largest chunk of the money goes to homeowners who live in an owner-occupied home. And then there's an additional chunk paid for with some surplus money. And some of that money goes to all property taxpayers. But you're right, Idahoans just got their property tax notices in November. They're just seeing the savings this year. When I talked to Ada County Treasurer Elizabeth Mann about this, she said the median savings for Ada County homeowners is $526 this year. So it is a significant amount of money. And actually, property taxes are just going to be due coming up on December 20th. But that was an area that Idahoans has identified was something that was bothering them, something they needed the legislature to take action on. We're just starting to see that this year. And but I do know I was on a telephone town hall event with Governor Brad Little a few weeks ago, and people are still concerned about the cost of living, still concerned about the cost of housing, still concerned about their property taxes, particularly older residents and residents on a fixed income. So it's an issue that continues to face Idaho, this growth that we're experiencing. But the first round, the first year of cuts and relief just reached Idahoans recently. So we're going to continue to follow that in the upcoming session for sure there, Gemma.
So Clark, really quickly, is this tax relief, does it continue? Or was this a one-time property tax relief?
That's a great question, Jim. And it does continue, but it's going to be added up and calculated each year. And so depending on valuations of homes, depending on levies set by your local cities, counties, and school districts, it is going to be different next year. Also, whether or not Idaho has a budget surplus will affect the amount of money that's going to be available to property taxes. The overall funding source is shifting. It's going to be relying more on taking money from sales tax collections to pay these property tax reductions. But yes, it is a multi-year program designed to provide savings for several years, but it's going to be calculated differently and all over again each year. And depending on what the budgets are at the local level, and then depending on whether or not there's a state budget surplus, the amount could be very different, but there are going to be savings continuing for years to come under this program, Gemma.
Jimmy and Scott, would love your thoughts on this. This is St. Luke's chipping away at Ammon Bundy last year, taking over his property in Emmett and scrubbing his websites from the internet. So whomever wants to start, but can we get a quick background on this case? Because that is very general with what I just said about what happened in this.
Sure. Far-right activist and one-time gubernatorial candidate in Idaho, Ammon Bundy, has gone missing as of this taping. He was, earlier this year, he lost a defamation lawsuit earlier this year to St. Luke's Health System over a child custody case involving the grandson of Diego Rodriguez, who is a close associate with Ammon Bundy. The two of them were sued. St. Luke sued both of them for defamation, for statements they made that were libelous and defamatory to the health system. They were not cooperative. Ammon Bundy and Diego Rodriguez were not cooperative with the court cases. They ended up losing the suit, and they were ordered to pay $52.5 million. And the judge in the case ordered that that Ammon Bundy turn over his house. He had a house and a ranch in Emmett, and he was ordered to turn over that house and the land and all of the belongings inside the house as partial payment toward the defamation lawsuit. Well, before that could all happen, Mr. Bundy and his family have disappeared. They've gone dark. They apparently have taken all of the belongings that were in the house and on the property with them, cleaned the place out. The property did get turned over from the owner of the property, but the whereabouts of Mr. Bundy are unknown at this time.
Jimmy, do we know then, is there a next in this case? And why I ask that is, as Scott mentioned, they're supposed to be paying upwards of 50 some million dollars. And, you know, and that hasn't happened yet. Nobody knows where they are now.
Yeah, I mean, there are several next steps, including payment for that, which I believe Diego Rodriguez has appealed to the Idaho Supreme Court. You know, earlier this year, I guess it was mid-November, was the last court, you know, supposed to be his most recent court appearance, but he didn't show up to that one, which he has a history of doing. He apparently wrote an email to Judge Nancy Baskin saying, quote, "I have much more important matters to attend to other than going to court." And this was after Judge Baskin had delayed the hearing so that he could go harvest his fruit orchard, I believe. So he's been scheduled to face contempt charges in the case. You know, he continued to attack St. Luke's online as well as, you know, Diego Rodriguez as well. Continued those attacks, which the hospital was trying to get them to stop. Judge Baskin ordered, you know, his original $10,000 bond forfeited, ordered a new $250,000 bail, you know, amount set for him. A warrant is out for his arrest if they can find him. Just so many unanswered questions we have to look forward to if and when he's ever apprehended.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, Jimmy. Melissa, can you talk to us about the death penalty in Idaho? Because we started off the year with legislation that would allow inmates to be executed by a firing squad. And then we did have some updates on a couple of death row cases. And Scott, chime in too as well, because I know you covered this. But Melissa, can we start just with some background on that?
Absolutely. For years now, the state has had trouble procuring lethal injection drugs from through legal means or normal means. It's increasingly harder for states that still have the death penalty to obtain drugs that are used in lethal injections and executions. To address that, the state legislature passed a bill that would allow the use of firing squads in executions if and when the state cannot procure those lethal injection drugs. It passed both chambers of the legislature. The governor let it become law, but with some reservations. He wrote a letter to the legislature and really to the public, saying that he was concerned about the impact that this would have on the state employees who would be tasked with carrying out these executions by firing squad. That also had an appropriation with it to build that facility. There are two men who have had death warrants served. Thomas Creech Creech and Pizzuto. And, mm-hmm. This has kind of been playing out in hearings. That's very normal with executions, that there are appeals, there are attempts to delay. Added onto that, though, is this drama of the firing squad. The facility isn't yet built, right? So even if there were a death warrant issued, that wouldn't be something that would be a reality anytime soon. But the fact of the matter is, we have two men who have executions that could happen in the next couple years. And that is a possibility if it happens. Meanwhile, the state did get lethal injection drugs for Creech, whose death warrant was issued in October. But that, once again, was delayed. He has an appeal coming up in January. But that's, that's an ongoing issue that Idaho and other states are going to have to keep an eye on when it comes to, if you have the death penalty, how do you carry out those executions and comply with the state's law when these lethal injection drugs, when pharmaceutical companies don't want to supply them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is such a question right there. Absolutely. Kevin, the Idaho legislature has been mulling school choice over. This has kind of been going on for a couple of years, kind of got a little bit of traction last year. So give us a little bit of background on this, on what happened in 2023. But I'm also curious about your thoughts as we are approaching the 2024 legislative session, if we're going to see this again.
Oh, we're definitely going to see it in 2024. Yeah. So let's recap what we saw in 2023, because I think that's a good prelude to what to expect next month. Legislature looked at several different forms of school choice. And school choice, it depends on the terminology you want to use. We can be talking about tax credits. We can be talking about scholarships for students attending private schools. Critics say that these are all variations of vouchers, and that's the term that critics attach to all of these proposals. You did see a bill get through the Senate that would have allowed for private school credit, tax credits and scholarships. That never got a hearing in the House Education Committee. You had this really interesting dichotomy between the Senate Education Committee, which is very conservative, very hardline conservative, very friendly to school choice, and House Education Committee, which is a lot more moderate, chaired by Julie Yamamoto, who has been pretty skeptical of school choice legislation in the past. So you've got that deadlock between the Senate and the House. And I would expect that you're going to see multiple proposals in the school choice arena in 2024. And it will be really interesting to see if anything threads the needle that the House Education Committee would go along with, that the Senate Education Committee would feel goes far enough. And factor in, as we'll talk about anything legislative related in the next couple of segments, it's an election year. All 105 seats in the legislature are up for grabs. We're going to have very heated legislative primaries, especially involving legislators who have a place on these education committees, who have a voice on education issues. So, short answer to your question, yeah, we're definitely going to see school choice back in 2024. I expect it's going to be one of the most heated debates, not just in the education space in this next legislative session. I think it's going to be one of the most heated issues, period, at the next session.
So I know we're wrapping 2023 and talking about year in review, but I do want to stay on this topic for just a minute. And Clark and Jimmy, I'd love your thoughts on school choice as well, because I know both of you covered it And I mean, as Kevin said, it got some traction last year. But, you know, how do we potentially see this playing out come 2024?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that we're just early enough that, you know, the legislative session begins on January 8th, and I certainly haven't covered it closely in the way that Kevin has, but I think we're just a little bit too early to see how it's going to play out. But I think Kevin was right that what happened last year could be sort of a prelude or an indication of what could happen this year. And he's exactly right about the interesting dynamics between the Senate Education Committee and the House Education Committee. But this is a debate that's been going on for years. I think they picked up some momentum in the last couple of years with some U.S. Supreme Court rulings that for the side that wants to be able to spend tax dollars for things like tuition at private schools, that gives them the opening to do so in their minds. And so I don't know exactly what the strategy is going to be. I haven't seen any particular pieces of legislation, but I think Kevin's exactly right that it's going to be one of the biggest issues of this session. And it really fits nicely for a lot of these legislators in with their campaign messages that they're going to be delivering ahead of those state primary elections this year that will be coming up. So I'm going to stay tuned and watch and see and I'm not quite sure where it's going to go, but I didn't know if Jimmy or Kevin had anything they wanted to add real quick before we take a break.
Yeah, something that I'm kind of wondering about is we had Senate Pro Tem Chuck Winder reprimanding a handful of far-right senators, including two members of the Senate Education Committee. We haven't seen any moves to remove them from that committee. However, you know, one of them, Senator Brian Lenny from Nampa, was removed as vice chair of the Senate Commerce and Human Resources Committee. You know, over these controversies with Winder saying that they were attacking other members of the caucus, et cetera. So I'm wondering, you know, they have not stayed quiet about those reprimands. So I'm wondering if, you know, there might be potential other, you know, removals from chairmanships or removals from committees as well.
Kevin, Idaho Governor Brad Little vetoed a bill during the last legislative session that would have fined libraries that kept, quote, harmful material on their shelves. But that wasn't the end of this controversy here in our state. So tell us why this debate is not over.
Well, it's not over partly because of what we talked about in the previous segment. It's an election year. This is going to be an election year issue in the legislature because you have a number of legislators who really believe that the legislature ought to step in with state policy on library materials. You're seeing a lot of this kind of playing out at the local level. You have, you know, school districts like West Ada just recently removing books from library shelves. But I think you've got legislators who believe that this is something that the state ought to step in and do something about. The governor's veto at the end of the session and the near override of that veto in the House, I think that leaves a lot of legislators thinking that they want to revisit this issue. And you've got Republicans who have censured Little and have censured some of the legislators who voted to uphold the veto. This whole issue is ripe for being revisited at the next legislative session. No question about that.
So, Kevin, I mean, a lot of this, as you mentioned, then of course we're going to see something more come, you know, January 8th or once the session begins in 2024. But does so much of this, as you said, really go back to the fact that this is an election year and this is a hot topic, like it or not?
You know, I feel like the best way to look at this upcoming legislative session is to, you know, go back to the fact that it's an election year and view everything through that prism, whether we're talking about education, whether we're talking about libraries, whether we're talking about tax policy. You know, this is such an interesting election year coming up. I've been tracking it already. The money that is coming into these legislative primaries already, it's very unusual and it's pretty extensive. We haven't even seen much of the fundraising reports, because really all the legislators need to do right now and the candidates need to do is report their large contributions. So we'll see those reports next year. I think these are going to be really expensive and really heated legislative races all throughout the state. So whether you're talking about whatever issue you're talking about, you have to look at it from the standpoint that it's going to be an election year in May, right after the session.
Well, and Kevin, I mean, you know, you're saying, right, you're already seeing how expensive some of these campaigns are, right? I know you've talked about this on our program before, even seeing like record amounts of money for things like school board elections in 2023.
I think politics has just become more more heated, more expensive at every level. I mean, we had legislative primaries last year, and Clark and Melissa and Jimmy, y'all follow this too. We had primaries, legislative primaries, where candidates raised over $100,000. I'm thinking about the race in District 1 in North Idaho, Scott Herndon and Jim Woodward, who are going to face off again in May. They're already raising money, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. That's probably going to be another six-figure primary between those two candidates. No question about it. And I think you'll see those all throughout the state.
So, Jimmy and Clark and Melissa, I would love your thoughts on this then. I mean, is this kind of what we're going to be looking at in the future, is just these, no matter kind of what the position is, whether it's like a local school board election all the way up to the state legislature, just more money being thrown at these campaigns?
I think more money is inevitable, especially because right now there's such a huge divide within the Republican Party itself. So these primary elections, when, you know, historically they've been fairly cheap, but with that schism of the far right versus more traditional conservative Republicans just deepening, you know, they are finally fighting back against the far right candidates, I would say. You know, there's been some kind of pushback, but now you have at least a couple PACs that I can think of off the top of my head running ads against them, trying to get them unseated and reinstall you know, the candidates that they had previously beaten back in those positions.
Adding to that, you know, infighting in the Republican Party isn't new. I earlier this month, I spoke to Attorney General Raul Labrador and asked him about the current state of the Republican Party, because we've seen so many of these fights, whether we're talking about raising money for primary races or talking about reprimands from Senate leadership, as was mentioned earlier, or these social media fights or these competing PACs. These fights within the GOP are very, very public right now. But the Attorney General pointed out, and he's the former chairman of the Republican Party himself, that these fights are nothing new. What's new is certainly the social media aspect of it, the high money primary races, but they've always taken, this infighting has always taken different forms, and it ebbs and flows, right? Sometimes it's a lot more vitriolic and a lot more public, and sometimes it's a little bit more smooth. And certainly it matches the tenor of the national conversation too. And there are different factors here as far as changing Republican Party rules to, you know, hold lawmakers accountable if they're not voting exactly with the Republican Party or, you know, conservative enough, quote unquote. But the theme of the fighting, that has been around since the Republican Party has been a supermajority in Idaho for about the past 30 years, he said. And I thought it was an interesting take.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to talk a little bit more in depth about that in the next segment. But I want to get back to another really hot topic, not just here in Idaho, across the nation, and that's gender-affirming care. And I know Jimmy and Scott, both of you have covered this. Jimmy, let me start with you. Can you talk about the fight over what's going on here in Idaho, which really did heat up this last year?
Yeah, it really did. And this is something that has been, you know, discussed for several years, whether or not it's, you know, transgender individuals changing their sex on their driver's licenses, their birth certificates, changing names, etc. But this particular year, the legislature passed a law that outlawed gender-affirming care for minors. So hormone therapy, puberty blockers, any kind of surgery, which many doctors and organizations testify that that's not happening in Idaho. That law is set to take effect January. Just as the new year turns, there's a lawsuit going on right now in federal courts with Judge Lynn Windmill still, as of this taping, considering a preliminary injunction to block that law from taking effect. We don't yet know if that's going to happen. But yeah, you just had all kinds of rhetoric from lawmakers on the floor that doesn't really jive with the truth about this. Certainly there are health complications and considerations that parents and transgender children need to take into account for these types of therapy, whether it's appropriate. You know, I spoke with several doctors talking about their particular regimens and how they go about doing this. It's a years-long process, usually. They say it's done with extreme care and, you know, shouldn't be outlawed. All of the major health and physician organizations across the country with hundreds of thousands of members say that this is necessary. They back gender-affirming care. But this would, you know, Idaho would join, you know, several states, a handful of states who have also outlawed this, but those are also being challenged as well. So we'll have to see what Judge Windmill has to say here in the next coming weeks. Otherwise, it's going to be criminalized.
This has been another topic that, of course, has made headlines all across the country. It is impacting more than half of our population. And this is abortion care or lack thereof and the abortion bans here in Idaho, along with all across the country. So, Melissa, can you start this conversation with the impacts that Idahoans have seen with the overturning of Roe v. Wade and where we are now, a year and a half later?
As you mentioned, it's something that we're seeing play out all across the country, and Idaho, with its near total abortion ban, isn't an exception. We're seeing women who are traveling hours away or flying to Portland to obtain abortion, and in some cases for very wanted pregnancies where they found out that the fetus has a fatal abnormality, isn't compatible with life. Where there are severe pregnancy complications that may not be life-threatening at the moment, but are certainly health-threatening or fertility-threatening, where if you continue with this pregnancy, you may not be able to have children again in the future. And, you know, for a fetus that has a slim to no chance of survival. There are multiple cases that have been filed challenging the abortion bans. One has been resolved, others are in various stages. Mm-hmm. And we continue to cover those on Idaho Reports. But we've seen, in addition to the women who have been affected by this, we're also seeing OBGYN physicians who are no longer practicing in the state, whether they've moved to other states to work or they have changed their practice. We've mm-hmm. seen that particularly with the small number already of high-risk OBGYNs who practiced in the state before. Some of those have already left, and that left women who were pregnant with high-risk pregnancies, with complex pregnancies, having to scramble to find care. And, a lot of those doctors have given multiple interviews where they directly cited the abortion ban and the criminal liability that would be placed on doctors if the prosecutor challenged their medical decisions. They cited that as the reason they left. Lawmakers have expressed interest in tweaking that law. It didn't happen in the 2023 session. We'll see what happens in 2024, but we are already seeing those effects on medical care.
Mm-hmm. And Melissa, so do we know moving forward, as you mentioned, I mean, coming into an election year again, right? This has been a very heated topic across the country. So, I mean, could we see movement? I mean, I know, as you said, they've shown some interest, but that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to see movement.
Exactly. And we saw interest in 2023 as well. And we saw a couple tweaks to the law, you know, clarifying that ectopic pregnancies don't count under the ban, that a doctor can treat an ectopic pregnancy before a woman is on her deathbed, right? There is absolutely interest in tweaking that law even further and addressing some things like the health and fertility of the mother. I don't know what's going to pass, right? None of us do, but there's certainly there is interest running concurrently with these legal challenges in both state and federal court. Meanwhile, there are still women who are having to, you know, once again, travel to get treatment for pregnancies in some cases that were very, very wanted. And so just like I think everybody else in the country, we're waiting to see how this affects, you know, how this plays out in the courts, but also elections. And remember, too, this isn't just an issue that's going to affect state and federal elections. This could come into play in county prosecuting elections. This could be an issue that people running for county prosecutor could in counties that have hospitals could say could make a campaign issue, right? Where they say, this is something that I'm going to aggressively prosecute, or this is something that I'm not going to make a priority if I get elected. So this has a lot of implications that we're still seeing play out a year and a half into it.
So Clark, the Open Primary Initiative has managed to gather 50,000 signatures as of this taping, which could open the GOP primary up and create ranked choice voting in Idaho. So give us some background on this. And Jimmy, of course, jump in here too, because I know you've been following this as well.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. And really anybody, I know everybody on the program today has covered the initiative in some form or another. But yeah, you're exactly right. The big news last week was that the open primary supporters had passed that 50,000 signature milestone. They actually have a couple of different requirements that they have to meet. And May 1st is the deadline. So there's still several months to meet the deadline, but they need about 63,000 signatures statewide. They're shooting for more than that in case some signatures are invalid or cannot be verified. And then they actually need to get 6% of the signatures from registered voters in 18 different legislative districts around the state. And that's arguably going to be the more difficult hurdle. They announced that they have cleared that hurdle in seven different legislative districts, and they have more, they're more than halfway there in seven others. So they really just launched the signature drive in August. They had a court battle with Attorney General Raul Labrador over some of the ballot language and ballot titles. And so they really didn't get started until August. They've already got 50,000 signatures and they have till May. But just to get in a little bit about what the initiative would do, it's known as the Open Primary Initiative, but it would make changes to both the primary election and the general election in a couple of different ways. It would get rid of the so-called closed primary elections that we've had in Idaho since 2011. It would replace those with a single primary election that all Idaho candidates and all Idaho voters would participate in, regardless of their party affiliation. And then from that primary, the top four vote getters, regardless of party affiliation, would advance to the general election. So you could have three Republicans and one Democrat, or two Democrats, a Republican and a Libertarian Party candidate, any mix really, just a single primary. But it would also replace the general election that we're used to with something called an instant runoff or ranked choice voting election system. And that's where Idahoans would vote for their favorite candidate, and then they could rank the other three candidates in order of preference, second, third, and fourth choice. And when it comes to the voting, the candidate with the fewest number of votes would be eliminated, and each vote for that candidate would instead go to the second choice candidate that those voters marked on their ballot. That's going to continue until there's two candidates left, and then the candidate with the most votes wins. That's kind of a simplified explanation. There's more information in the Capital Sun and certainly on Boise State Public Radio and on Idaho Reports program. But that's kind of a quick summary, but they're well on their way. And what they're hoping to do is get this on the November 2024 general election. And so voters ultimately will have the say. If they can meet their signature goal by May 1st, voters will be deciding in November 2024 when they go to vote for president and all these other important choices they'll make in the election. They'll decide on whether to pass the Open Primary Initiative. And if it gets that far, it'll just take a majority vote to pass it either way. So I know that we're all going to continue to cover it as they get closer to the deadline. But how about I take a break and let Melissa or Jimmy or Kevin fill in any final details on the ballot initiative before we move to wrap up?
And you know what? If we don't have anything on that, oh, I just have a couple minutes left. And I do want to get to the one topic that I think all of you put on the top of of, you know, the hot topics. And Melissa, you in fact gave it a name, and this is called Republican fratricide. I know we talked a little bit about this infighting, but Melissa, talk about the GOP party right now.
Yeah, it's a contentious fight within the Republican Party that has made a lot of headlines. It certainly made a lot of Republicans angry at the summer meeting for the state Republican Party this summer. They changed several rules that would basically make local central committees able to call elected officials to their committees to be able to basically hold them accountable or ask them questions about why they voted a certain way or didn't vote a certain way. And we're seeing that play out already in central committees across the state. These central committees, many of them have already, censured some of their lawmakers and elected officials. So again, GOP infighting is not new. This is just the latest iteration of it. This is the latest thing that these central committees and local officials are using to say, hey, you know what, legislature, Congress, Governor Little, we are not happy with the way you're taking things. And this is not uncommon in a state where you have a supermajority party, where the most vicious fights aren't between the Democrats and Republicans, they're within the same party. I'm very curious coming up into the legislative session, how it is going to affect or won't affect voting and lawmaking, whether these lawmakers are going to say, hey, I care about what the state Republican Party is saying, and maybe they have a point. You know, maybe I should check and see how I'm voting and make sure it aligns with the values of my central committee. Or if they say, you know what, to heck with this, I'm going to continue to vote the way I feel my constituents want me to vote and not the central committee. I think that is ultimately what has the most implications for the average Idahoan.
Well, I want to thank all of you for taking time to really look back on this last year as we move into the next year. So always appreciate all of the reporting all of you do. Many thanks to Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, and our very own James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Did you know you are physically adapting to all your swiping, scrolling, and tapping?
We're changing our bodies and what they're able to do through our habits.
NPR's Body Electric, a special interactive series investigating how to fix the relationship between our tech and our health. Listen in the TED Radio Hour feed wherever you get your podcasts.